Hi, everybody. I have with us Peter Chubb today from UNSW, and he's going to talk about power virtualization without pain. So, hand you straight over.
Yeah. Is this actually working? Yeah. Okay. Speaking just after Rusty is always a bit of a disadvantage. He's got so much razzmatazz, and I'm just going to tell you what I can tell you. Most of what I'm talking about is not my work. It was based on stuff that Matt Chapman did as an early prototype of his BNUMA stuff, and has since been changed by myself and by Myrta Zender, a master student from ETH Zurich, who did her practicum time with us. So although I was involved in all of it and did quite a bit of it, it's not all my work, so that up front. Normally, when you've got a machine, you've got some applications running, and they're sitting on top of a kernel, and the kernel sits on top of the hardware. And any time the user space application wants to do something that touches the hardware, that operation is mediated by the kernel. The kernel also does some stuff like multiplexing between applications and giving each application the illusion that it's got its own hunk of the machine. What we want to do is deprivilege the kernel, just push it up a little. Is that mine? Oh, geez. Sorry. Kirk. Figures. No more mobile phones, please. So we're going to put a virtual machine monitor layer in between the kernel and the hardware. This all works fine, sort of. There are two different kinds of virtual machine monitor. There's the kind I just showed you where the virtual machine monitor sits directly on top of the hardware. And you use that where you want to... Oh, shut up, you. Where you want to run more than one instance of an operating system and get good performance. Hypervisors like that are things like the hypervisor that runs on your PowerPC that partitions the machine for you, or VMware Workstation, or sorry, Server, where it runs all the bare metal and then you run other operating systems on top, and most of the users never actually see the virtual machine. The other sort is this sort. That's like VMware Workstation and like UML and like Linux on Linux, which I'm going to talk about later. There, you've got a thinnish layer, the VMM, that traps privileged operations from the kernel running in user space and then converts those into system calls that talk to the kernel. The difference between these will become more apparent and more important later on as we go through the talk. The core virtualization problem is that, theoretically at least, performing an operation that changes system state traps. And if you're running in user space on top of a normal kernel in a Type 2 virtual machine monitor, that will generate a sigil or a sig trap or something that the virtual machine monitor can trap and do something with. The problem is that reading system state doesn't always trap. There's lots of system registers that you can write in a privileged mode, but when you read them, it doesn't trap. That's not a problem for a Type 1 virtual machine because it can multiplex those registers between the ones on top. But for a Type 2 virtual machine, it is a problem because the contents of those registers is controlled not by the virtual machine monitor, but by the underlying host kernel. So you need to do something about it. The main problem is that the system and the user state is not completely cleanly separated. And this is true for almost all modern architectures, even with the Van der Poel exceptions. And the other problem is that trapping is slow. The Van der Poel extensions are some stuff that Intel added to IA32 architecture, and there's also the Silverdale extensions for the IA64, that essentially add an extra layer of privilege underneath the normal most privileged layer. And theoretically at least, although I haven't had my hands on one of these to try it, all of the things that should have trapped in the original architecture but didn't now do. So you can do all of your stuff here. It's still a bit slower than you'd want it to be. Itanium is significantly easier to virtualize than IA32. It's got fewer of these special instructions that should trap but don't. But it's still non-trivial. In particular, there's a number of instructions that, like cover, that behave differently depending on whether interrupts are turned on or off. It saves some extra state into a register if interrupts are off when you execute it. Now, if you're executing in a deprivileged state, it doesn't trap. So the hypervisor doesn't know to do something different for it. You know, it just goes along and does the normal user space thing. So that's a problem. and T-hash and T-tag reveal not the virtualized page table details, but the real ones. So you've got to do something about all these. So, theoretically, if all of these privileged instructions tracked, you could use what I'm going to call full virtualization, where your hypervisor, your virtual machine monitor, relies entirely on being tracked to for any time when you change system state or need it. That doesn't exist. So we've got to move down towards paravirtualization, which I'm going to define for the purposes of this talk as where you change the binary of the operating system you're running so as to make it easier to virtualize. And there are hybrid techniques between the two where you change some of the things and not all of them. For a fully paravirtualized system, you would actually extend the instruction set architecture to do other things. So you could tell the hypervisor, okay, I'm going to do a context switch now, which isn't normally a primitive in your instruction set. One of the ones that Xen for IA64 uses is this thing he calls optimized paravirtualization. They let most things trap. They change the things where they've got to change it for correctness. And then they profile the hypervisor operating system combination. And anywhere where there's a hotspot, they add more paravirtualized operations. So that's what that does. Another technique that's used by VMware on IA32 machines, that's binary rewriting. So when you run VMware workstation, it grabs the operating system you're trying to run, scans the instructions and rewrites them. For various reasons, that's tricky on IA64, primarily because there's no single instruction way to save a register, and you can't do anything without a register. So what we want to be able to do, if you're rewriting the binary, is replace the non-trapping instructions with ones that do trap, and maybe add some extra calls into the hypervisor for performance as well. So our approach is slightly different from this. To paravirtualize this Itanium, the first thing you want to do is provide overridable access functions for privileged instructions. Now that's already done to support the Intel C compiler. All those inline assemblies that you'll see throughout other architectures just isn't there for Itanium. But that doesn't help for the manually written assembler, of which there's a reasonable amount for doing things like traps and low-level interrupt handling and stuff. And then, at least what Xen does, is it places key routines to set up page tables and stuff like that with calls into the hypervisor. But doing all that stuff is really painful. Going through and finding all those instructions that you need to modify in order to have operations is really, it's painful, it's error-prone, and it produces a fairly large patch that it's rather difficult to push upstream to a community that, until fairly recently, hasn't cared that much about virtualization, even if it's the buzzword of the month now. The assembler already has to be able to recognize all those sensitive instructions in order to assemble it. So why do it by hand when you've got a perfectly good tool for doing it? So, our approach. And this is due to Matt Chapman, it's not mine. What he did was he wrote a little Perl script that scans assembly language and replaces significant instructions, those sensitive instructions, with assembly language macros that does stuff. Theoretically, at least, the script can save the addresses then in a special ELF section, and then we can just make some binary rewriting at runtime in the space that's been made available by those macros. Let's give you an example. Let's say the original has this instruction. This is to turn off interrupt selection. We can replace it with that instruction plus a whole heap of knobs. Due to the nature of the Itanium, knobs come almost free because you issue them in parallel with your instruction, and they just don't, and the number of cycles between that instruction and the next instruction remains unchanged. And then at operating system load time, you can replace it with thisness. This assumes that register 5 and 6 are available for some reason, and that's a different problem which I don't propose to go into now. That's theoretically what we could do. In practice, because for the work that I'm doing, at least for the user mode Linux type stuff, we have to make so many other changes anyway. I'm not bothering the binary rewriting at runtime. I'm just doing this straight away in the assembly replacement. Having done that, you then need to interface between your hypervisor and the kernel. And that's done by means of a thing we call the wedge. All that does is it's kind of impedance transformer, an interface transformer between the power virtualized kernel and whatever hypervisor you happen to be using. Okay, you with me so far? Okay. This works pretty well. These are some LMbench results. I only took the ones that really changed a lot, plus a few that stayed the same, so you can see that most of the things that people care about remain the same. I mean, all the file operations are virtually the same, whether it's paravirtualized or in native mode. The native column is bare metal. The manual is Xen as it comes out of Xensource, fully Atomium. And the auto is Matt Chapman's automatically paravirtualized, pre-virtualized system. And as you can see, some things actually get slightly faster. I mean, some things get a bit slower, but context switch is slightly faster. The reason for that is that we're picking up more of those sensitive instructions to change, whereas the Xen is optimally paravirtualized, and they only pick up some of them and let the rest trap. Yep? Because we're not putting any higher level... Sorry, the question was, why do things get slower, some things? And that's because we're not paravirtualizing at as high a level. We're only doing the sensitive instructions.
Yeah, but then
we'll
get
trapped
anyway.
Yeah, but okay, they would get trapped anyway. But Xen also adds hypervisor calls when you change page tables and change address spaces and things like that, which we're not doing. Now my train of thought's gone, sorry. Oh, that's right. The other nice thing about this is that in order to do the automatic paravirtualization, we only needed to change 20 source lines, and most of those were in makefiles. Whereas the size of the Xen patch to Linux to get it to work on the manually paravirtualized way is something like 5,000 lines. Is that correct, Matt? Yeah. It's about that order of magnitude. If you're at the open day, we actually had the exact figures on the wall. So from a 5,000 line patch to do that well to a 20 line patch plus a Perl script to do that well sounds pretty good to me. Okay, let's type 1 VMMs. Can we do the same thing with type 2 VMMs? And the answer is yes, but it takes a bit more change to the kernel. You're probably all familiar with UML on x86. It's extremely heavily paravirtualized. There's not that much left of the standard kernel by the time you put all that the UML stuff in it. It's so different that they've even added an extra architecture in the Arch directory for UML code. So what do we need to do on Itanium to do something that works as well? Well, first thing we need to do is, if you're going to run a Linux kernel entirely in user space, the Linux kernel steals part of the address space. And unless you do something, the virtualized kernel is also going to try and steal the same hunk of address space. So what you need to do is, firstly, rearrange the memory map entirely. In order to make things easy for ourselves, Itanium Linux can already run on top of this thing called a SCII simulator, which is a thingy from Hewlett-Packard that simulates the Itanium instruction set. It's got two simulated devices, an Ethernet, a disk, and a console. We're just going to reuse the infrastructure for that to make it simple. So the main problem is system calls by a break, and I'll come back to that in a minute. This is the way we rearrange things. This is the standard memory layout. The area in brown is the area that's available for user programs. As you can see, two lumps of that have already been allocated to particular uses. Region 0 is used for IO32 compatibility. So if you've got an x86 executable you try and run, you've got a maximum of 36 bits of address space there, 32 for a user space program. You can map all of that in the bottom bit of this. And the other area is region 4, which is used for huge pages. If we keep those as huge pages and IO32 emulation, there aren't enough regions to run a virtualized Linux. So we're going to say, okay, no huge pages and no IO32 compatibility in either. Right? So we just move it like that. The blue area is the bit that's still stolen by the host kernel. The user region is now 1-3, which is what user programs use anyway, so we haven't changed anything there, so all your user applications will run exactly unchanged. And we'll treat region 0 as all of the top 3 regions normally. Also in there, we'll put the virtual machine monitors text and data, and a mapping of a big file, which is the pseudo-physical memory to the whole virtual machine. Right? So that's what we do. We also need to move the per CPU variables. Per CPU variables are special in that they're accessed inside the kernel by an offset from either zero or the top of the address space. So given that we want to be able to keep that instruction format, we have to move the per CPU variables mapped right down the bottom here instead of right at the top, which we can't get at. Okay. The green area there is the gate page. There's two things the gate page is used for. One is fast system calls. So in order to get into the kernel, you can either do a trap instruction or you can branch to an offset which is well known inside that gate page. That's number one. Number two is it's got the signal trampoline in it for returning from signals into user space. I said that system call via break, the break instruction, is a problem. If you think about it, if you're running in user space and you do a break 1000 to do a system call, the thing that's going to see that is not your hypervisor or your kernel, it's the host kernel. And it's not going to make any sense to it because it hasn't got access to the actual real data. It's just wrong. So what you need to do is find some way of intercepting that instruction and redirecting it to the hypervisor to generate a trap interrupt into the guest kernel. The way we're doing that at the moment is using ptrace, because ptrace is the only user space mechanism you've normally got to look at system calls and then do something with them. And this is what happens. First you get the break, it drops into the host kernel, goes up to the ptracer process, which then converts the system call into a get PID, which is harmless and idempotent. So it then goes back into the host kernel, back into the ptracer again. At this point, we can deliver a signal to the virtual machine monitor. The signal in the virtual machine monitor says, okay, great. Now we know that we've just had a trap, and we'll generate a trap interrupt into the guest kernel. So we'll do that, but then we've got to call sigreturn. And sigreturn is another system call, so it goes back into the host kernel, and then back into the ptracer. Ptracer finally continues the guest kernel, which has finally got it. So we've now got something like 6 context switches because we've delivered one system call from user space. This makes system calls incredibly slow, as you can imagine. So let's hack it. Firstly, we don't want to do this for the virtual machine monitor itself. It should be able to run its system calls unimpeded. So we'll add a new system call, a new ptrace option to say only deliver the ptrace events if the address of the instruction that does the trap is within these particular ranges. And that way, you can exclude the virtual machine monitor's instructions. That's pretty useful. Next, that sigreturn system call. The problem there is that ptrace tells you when your system call is started and when it finishes. So even though the adder range means that you don't see the start of the system call, when it returns, it's returning into the guest kernel or into the guest user space. So that stops you. So what I did was I added a PT one-shot flag inside the kernel so that if you're in sigreturn, it sets this flag and doesn't do the ptrace on the sigreturn. Next, ptrace doesn't just stop for system calls, it also stops on signals. And if you're running in user space, you're getting an awful lot of signals. Every time you get a page fault, it's emulated with a SIGSEGBI. Every time you do a system call, you get those SIGTRAP generated. And you also get your timer interrupts emulated by signals. So let's not stop on signals. We're out of PT no six stop flag. And there is one other minor change. We want to be able to set the PSR bit for that we've got a dirty high partition in order for correctness. Otherwise, the floating point partition inside the real kernel gets out of step with the one in the guest. For now, we're linking the wedge with the operating system. It's only small anyway. It's about 200 lines of code of assembler. The hacks to the guest prevents use on the bare metal or the simulator because we've rearranged the address space anyway. So there's no real penalty to linking the wedge and not doing that binary rewriting I told you about. And at the moment, development's harder than it might be because you've got to have the ptrace process to check system calls. You can't run GDB on the thing. While I was doing the benchmarking for this talk, I worked out a way of getting rid of the ptracer entirely. And I want to try that out next week. And if so, we'll have a really great talk because you can just run GDB on your guest kernel. And that would be great. But the really nice thing is that this work only took 5 days part-time. That's the beauty of the afterburning work. And these are the results we get. The vert one there, well, these ones are the same ones you saw before. Vert is the fully virtualized. All we did was change sensitive instructions to ones that trapped. The top line is the Linux on Linux with all the parrot virtualization stuff that I've been talking about and those hacks to the kernel. So you can see that context switch time is like 200 times more than the native. That's still not good enough. The main problem now is address space switching. I'll come to that in a minute. But the file I.O. is reasonable. I mean, it's very similar to the native file I.O. So that's pretty neat. It's better than it before. The main overheads are still system calls, I.O., and context switch time. But it's still too slow. Another improvement is if we can get rid of those system calls via break and just use the fast system call mechanism inside the guest, things get a lot better. That means adding to the afterburner support for the enter privileged code instruction and adding something which tells you when you leave privileged code. Normally, there's this magic page and you've got an EPC instruction in there. And if you hit it while you're in the magic page, it enters privileged mode within a couple of cycles. But there's no way to tell you when you get out of that mode. So we had to add an un-EPC instruction to get out. That leads to about fewer context switches per system call because the ptracer doesn't actually get used anymore, except for clone and fork, which glib, for some reason, glibc, uses system call via break for fork and clone and exec, but not for anything else. Oh, and, of course, legacy statically linked programs, which means you still need the ptracer. I also added eager remapping of the address spaces. Where is this? And the final thing we're going to add is direct access to hardware using the user-level driver framework I reported on here 2 years ago and at OLS a year and a half ago. Okay, these are the results. Without any of those hacks, it takes about 150 minutes to do a kernel compile. That's a long time, 2.5 hours. Just adding PT Adder range drops it to 98 minutes. That's too long. Adding the node 6 stop drops it to 50 minutes. Now we're talking. Paravirtualizing it, that's adding the afterburner, and turning on fast system calls drops it to 36 minutes. Now we're getting into the time when a kernel developer might reasonably wait to do a kernel. But it's still too slow. And the native it only takes 18 minutes. Most of the time in there is context switch time. This is a diagram of how the context switching works, address-based switching, I should say. We've got a disk file that's mapped one-to-one into what I'm going to call physical memory. It's a virtual physical memory in low address space. That same stuff is mapped into various places one page at a time. So whenever we do a context switch, we need to unmap all those pages and map new ones according to the new context. Before I put the eager context switching in, we just used to unmap and then lazily, every page fault time, we'd map another one back in. With the eager stuff, when we detect a context switch by looking when the region registers get changed, we unmap everything and then map all the right ones in for the new address space. But all those nmap calls take time, particularly as they're all one-page size things, and some of the things you're trying to map have huge address spaces. So what we need to be able to do is, inside the kernel, multiplex multiple address spaces into a single process to make this work. And that's another thing which I'm planning to work on fairly soon. Virtual I.O. In Zen, which is an example of a virtual machine monitor. When a guest operating system other than DOM 0 wants to do some I.O., it talks to some kind of simulated device which talks back to a real device driver in DOM 0, which then talks directly into the hardware. Can we do the same thing for Type 2 VMware? And I can't see why not. We use the user-level driver framework we developed. The main things it provides are DMA and interrupt handling. The difficult parts now are device discovery. How do you generate an ACPI table that describes the virtual PCI buses that the virtual machine is supposed to have? And I've got a student working on that right now. I/O space access. We need some clean way to map bits of the I/O space into the kernels of the rest space of the guest. The problem there is that typically you want to use a large page size for performance, and PCI space is predicated on 4K pages. So somehow you need to, if you only want to make this device available and not the device that's sitting next to it in PCI space, you need to map with 4K pages. So there's a slight problem there. And I don't know quite what to do with that before we get variable page sizes in the kernel. Interrupts and DMA are reasonably well handled. We can set up a separate thread for doing interrupts, and DMA is just a matter of calling into the kernel to pin the pages and to set up scanning other lists, as we've already done. Okay, future work. Adding a gate page for VMM calls. So we can have instead of trapping, which causes a SIG trap when you want to do a hypervisor call, we could add a gate page for that you just call into and then call out of. That will speed things up massively, I expect. Finish the device driver work. And the other thing which I haven't got on this slide is, my brain's going crazy. That's right, remove the ptracer. Okay, that's most of the talk, but what I'd like to do is give you a quick demo. Here we are, we've got a virtual machine monitor. I was like, is it run VMM? Oh, my network's gone away. If anyone develops with the Broadcom card, please can you fix it? It loses association with the network quite often. Now we've got it. Maybe this will work now. Well, I was going to show you this. Pardon? Yeah, sure. Good. What if I connect to the H3? It was 5 minutes ago, right? Ah. Okay. Would you connect to it? You can give me a nice big screen and watch the H2 and show people. The really nice thing about this user mode Linux machine is that you can simulate as many processes as many processors as you want. Great, the whole thing or just the external? While we're getting this thing, have you got any questions? I know it was a lightning tour, didn't I? Yes, sorry. That's right, it was originally emitted by them. It wasn't their idea first, I think it came out by somebody else earlier than that.
It was based on some work by some Japanese guys, but the basic afterburning idea is Josh.
That's right. And they did most of the work on IS-32, and they were the ones who had the idea of the binary rewriting.
While I'm at it, why the hell don't you get rid of break by afterburning?
You still need something. Okay, because it's in all the user mode processes, not in the kernel. Did you have a problem, Malcolm?
No.
Okay. Peter.
Two questions. From what I gathered before, you were saying that even with the latest Intel extensions, you still don't have full hardware support for virtualization. Can you see that Intel eventually putting it in there?
That's too strong a word. That's not actually what I said. I said that it doesn't look to me from the published spec as if they have, but I haven't actually got my hands on one of these things to try it. And we're supposed to be getting a Montecito machine with these extensions real soon now, but it's been real soon now for over a year. So, I don't know. Yep. Andrew.
From all accounts, the Intel architecture really sucks when it comes to virtualization.
Yes.
I'm wondering if PowerPC is something you've looked at in terms of a better
platform. I have not looked at PowerPC. I'm paid to work on Itanium. But that being said, the PowerPC architecture already has a hypervisor. In fact, it's almost impossible to run the thing without a hypervisor. You can't get at the bare metal. All you can get at is the hypervisor layer, particularly on their bigger line. It's like the OS 360 running on top of VM. Yeah. You don't see the real habit. Well, actually, I was talking to Hugh about that. It's not as easy as they were making out. Questions over here?
I was at the virtualization talk by Rusty, and he was talking about something with binary writing, so essentially placing the defensive instruction with NOPs and then the defensive instruction, which looks very similar to what the afterburning work is. So is there any chance that the sort of work will merge? Or?
It's unclear to me at the moment where Rusty's work is going. The problem on Itanium is you can't easily open up a hole in the instruction stream to put new stuff in. You have to do it at assembly level rather than at binary time in general. The only other approach would be to decompile the binary and then open up the holes and then recompile it because of the way that things have to be patched into particular holes in the bundles and things. Otherwise, it's a bit difficult. Yep.
At compile time on IO64, you could actually add enough NOPs. You know, you could add a bundle or two, which is possible, and it wouldn't be very expensive to run it without modifying it if you're running natively. But it gets messy, and instruction encoding on IO64 is just nasty to do at runtime. So it could be done, but
that's right. It could be done, but it's a pain.
I mean, we have to in SEND, we have to do instruction decoding. Of the various instructions we are emulating, and it stinks. It's some very nasty and complex code.
Is that big enough? Can people read it?
Yeah.
Pick a number of CPUs. Make it relatively small, otherwise we'll all be all day booting.
Four.
How do I do that? Control plus? No. Okay, is that better? Okay, we're coming up. And as you can see, it's really quick to boot. And it looks just like Debian. Because it is Debian. Unfortunately, because the machine I wanted to demonstrate this on is disabled, and the one I've got is on a network where I can't actually easily add new IP addresses, we're getting IRQ problems from the Ethernet driver. That's here. And here we are. There they are, four processors for you. All running at 900 megahertz. And you can do stuff. I run LM Bench quite a lot, so you can see the kind of results we're getting. Oh, stupid thing, it hasn't set the size properly. But in there somewhere are the results that I showed you just now. You can't really see them, so there's not much point. Yep, any other questions?
Yeah.
Yep.
I guess I'm a little puzzled with this one. Do you see this as an optimization for SEN or a replacement or replacing one of the other I mean, kind of, as Rusty's and the guy's talk was, it's kind of, at the moment we seem to have hypervisor of the day.
Yep.
Some of them are good, some of them are bad. We could argue that some of the ones that are mainstream are maybe not the best ones. Shouldn't say any more. But do you think this is a base for something that will, is it more like, let's try and find out how it works, or do you actually see it becoming something people will be using?
I think it'd be useful for things like driver debugging, once we get the user level drivers working in them properly, because once I get rid of the ptracer, which I've also known how to do, we'll be able to run GDB on a live running kernel and do all the things you'd normally do in user space to debug your driver, and without having to reboot all the time when things crash and break. So that's one use. Secondly, I see this filling the niche that UML fills on IA32, only better.
So do you see this replacing UML on the long term?
Only for Itanium. I mean, UML doesn't run on Itanium. And that's the hole I was trying to fill.
Right, but why not port UML to Itanium then?
Because this is better.
I'm just asking provocative questions, but because it's kind of like we have so many things, and I'm not sure which one is better and which one is worse, sometimes
the reason,
having the discussion.
The reason I didn't want just to port UML is because I wanted to explore the afterburning technology.
Sure.
And also UML changes the operating system so much that it'd be useless for my goal of being able to debug device drivers. Because UML doesn't have any concept of that. It's using the Linux ADI as its underlying thing, not the Itanium one or the IA32 one. Okay. I also think I can outperform it.
How does the instruction rewriting cope with things like a JVM that creates code at runtime?
We're only rewriting kernel instructions. JVM shouldn't have any sensitive instructions because it's running entirely in user space and runs unprivileged.
Okay.
The only instructions we care about are the ones in the kernel, which affect the machine state, and it thinks it's running on bare metal and thinks it can access the PSR register to change interrupt control and things like that. JVMs don't do that.
That's one of the reasons you can't do instruction rewriting for user code?
Well, we don't do instruction rewriting for user code. Yeah. Any more?
Okay, thank you very much, Peter, for that talk.
I'll better bring this down.